Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to Jazz on the Tube. This is our podcast series, and today we're going to talk with a chronicler. And as you know, we focus in our podcasts on three different classes: people who chronicle the art and the music, people who are teachers, and then people who are producer-presenters. And in this case, we've got someone who's a perfect fit for what we do at Jazz on the Tube, a filmmaker who has documented and shown a bright light on one of the great players on the alto saxophone, Frank Morgan. The picture is coming out soon. We're going to talk about the details in a bit. It's called Sound of Redemption. Let me tell you, if you're near New York City, it opens December 2nd. I'll give you more details about that later at the end of the call. If you're in Southern California, it opens on December 18th, which I'm told is the same day that Star Wars opens. So you can actually see this film on the big screen. You know, we spend 99.9% of our time at Jazz on the Tube watching things on the small screen. So seeing this in a theater with beautiful photography and beautiful sound is going to be a really great experience. So I want to encourage everybody to just start by marking it on your calendar, and you'll probably end up going to, and I hope that you do. So our guest is the director, Nancy Hyken. Welcome, NC.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And you can find out more about NC at her website. So she's a filmmaker that's done a lot of different projects. It's NC Hyken, and that's HEIKIN.com, NCHyken.com. But we're going to be focusing on this movie, Sound of Redemption, the Frank Morgan story. Now, jazz fans know Frank Morgan as just an amazing alto player from the West Coast. Beautiful. Beautiful guy, beautiful music. Some of us are aware of, you know, some of the personal challenges he had. He spent an awful lot of time in prison. And yet he managed to continue with his art and develop it and expand it. And how he managed that, I don't know. Maybe that's one of the mysteries that this film is going to solve. So, NC, first of all, tell me how this film even came to be. Why Frank Morgan? Certainly a very good topic for a film, but why? How did you come to pick on Frank?
Well, I have a very good friend who's a very well-known crime fiction writer named Michael Connelly. And some of you, I bet a lot of your listeners know that he always talks about jazz in his books. He has his lead character, Harry Bosch, listening to jazz to relax while he's trying to solve murders. And one of his favorite musicians was Frank Morgan. Michael actually knew Frank and just loved him, loved his music, which is easy to do, as you know. But he also thought his story was really special. And he came to me and asked me if I'd be interested in doing this film. He wanted to do it. And, you know, when somebody like Michael Connelly comes and asks you, tells you this is a good story, you say, okay, yeah, I think you might be right.
Were you a jazz fan before this, or did this introduce you to the depth of jazz? I'm just curious.
No. I've been a jazz listener for a long time. I kind of fell out of it. I go from one music to another. But I definitely came back to it. A lot of people were familiar to me, but I was not familiar with Frank Morgan. So that was the first huge discovery was, my God, this guy is incredible. What a sound, what a sense of melody, lyricism. You know, nothing that wasn't beautiful ever came out of his horn. That was the way I felt about it. Very straight from the heart, very emotional. And so that sold me right there, just listening to his music.
Great. Great. And he was, for people that who know the name but don't know where he sort of fits in the history of jazz, I think it would be fair to say that Frank Morgan was one of the protégés, one of the students, one of the acolytes of Charlie Parker. So he was, I don't like to put labels on musicians because it's, you know, it's kind of ridiculous, especially good musicians, because they can go in all kinds of directions. But you're looking at a bebop, hard bop kind of guy when you're talking about Frank Morgan.
Absolutely.
And the film's really interesting because for a lot of reasons, but one of them is it's built around a performance that took place at San Quentin. Now, I know that Frank Morgan spent time in San Quentin, but what's so interesting is this film, this concert was a tribute to him, performed at San Quentin after he passed away. Now, I don't think there's ever been a case in the history of music and or prisons that a former convict, was honored with a concert in the prison where he was held. How on earth did this come to be? And can you tell us a little bit about the concert, who was involved, and what happened? You shot it, by the way. You're the one that filmed it.
That's right. So here's what happened. I went into researching Frank's life and discovered a whole lot of stuff, including the fact that he spent 30 years in and out of jail, and that a lot of that time was at San Quentin. And part of the thing at San Quentin that was so fascinating was that there were so many jazz musicians there, all there on drug charges, that they had a big band. The warden was pretty enlightened, and they had this 16-piece big band, and they were renowned in the Bay Area as being fantastic. And there is, you know, people knew about this. There's actually a French journalist who wrote a book about it, but there is no actual documentation. There's like one or two pictures and no video, no recordings. And I thought, this is the most amazing thing. And I want to bring it to life. And I want to bring Frank's, it was a full third of his life that he was in jail. I wanted to somehow get there and get the feeling of that and bring that to life. What was it like to be among convicts for, you know, years at a time, with the only audience you had were your fellow prisoners? And so somehow or other, I came up with this idea of putting together a tribute concert where we could go into San Quentin, do a live concert, do it for the convicts. Not, you know, there was one left who had actually known him, but most of them were new guys, and just get the feeling. And I reached out to several musicians who either knew Frank or actually played with him or simply loved him. So that included Ron Carter, who recorded a couple of CDs with him. George Cables, great pianist who's recorded almost more than anyone else with Frank. His mentee, his protege, Grace Kelly, really rising star alto sax player herself, who I think Frank loved so much because he saw himself in her. He was such a prodigy at such a young age, and he wanted her to have the world the way he should have had it had he not digressed into drugs. I also had Delphio Marsalis on trombone, who emceed the event. I had Mark Gross on alto, who's a great player also, and just he adored Frank. And Delphio brought in Smitty Smith, who was a great drummer. So we had this, I mean, it was just a great band. They were incredible. And they came out, and the electricity in the room with these convicts, because everybody was kind of nervous, you know, about this whole thing. And it just turned out to be electric, emotional. We raised the roof. The prisoners were in awe of this music. It just got them, you know. It just went through them and lifted them up. And afterwards, the musicians all said they had rarely experienced a night like that, that it was something so memorable for them. So I used that as the backbone of the film. I had Delphio recount Frank's life to the prisoners because a lot of them didn't know who he was. And I was able to use that as a sort of narration, and it pops in and out. But there's also plenty of archival on Frank and interviews with his family and friends. So that's how I built the film. And it turned out to be marvelous. We have marvelous live music, and that weaves with Frank's own recordings, and it mounted into something special.
Now, the band that had been playing at San Quentin, was that still in existence at the time that this was recorded?
No, you know, jazz has sort of fallen out of favor. There are some jazz workshops there. There is a lot of music going on, but people tend to do more rock or rap and that kind of thing. But there is a jazz band, but they were, I mean, I can't tell you how appreciative those guys were to have that live concert.
Oh, it must have been.
It was an amazingly emotional experience. It was really spiritual. I like to say that, you know, when you do a documentary, sometimes you do these scenes that are recreations. That's what they're called, when you sort of shoot something that looks like it might have been Frank Morgan, let's say. And I didn't really want to do that, but I felt like I didn't recreate him. I resurrected him there in the prison. That's what we all felt. It was incredible.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, music does have all kinds of extra powers that are not easily quantifiable or explainable, and I wouldn't be surprised if you did bring his positive spirit back. So Jazz had kind of fallen by the wayside at San Quentin, so this event was bringing something back that hadn't been there in a long time, since Frank had left.
Well, I don't know about that. I wouldn't say it's completely disappeared, but they don't have a big band anymore. But, you know, surprisingly, after the concert, a lot of the prisoners knew all the members of the band, knew where they had played, who they'd play with, and they'd played with, and asked for autographs, and they were pretty up on their stuff. So this was by no means an uneducated audience.
Got it. Yeah, no, I wouldn't expect it to be an uninformed group. So there must have been some arranging that had to take place with the prison system and the warden. And I mean, you just don't knock on the door and say, we'd like to do a concert. And they just say, great, come on in. What was all involved in just the logistics of making the concert part happen?
It was complicated. I mean, it took us actually 14 months to get permission to go in. We asked permission and we were directed toward a warden, and then we were directed toward a state office, the California Correctional's office, and they directed us to someone else, and we kind of went round and round for a while. And our producer had a contact in Senator Feinstein's office that kind of helped us push it along. It sort of pushed it across the desk. We finally got in. One of the things that apparently was holding us up was that they hadn't had concerts in a long time in there. There might have been an incident or something the last time they did one, so they were a little wary of that. So we were the first to go in quite a while, over a couple of years, I think. And so that was also exciting for us.
Now, I think there have been, in the distant past, interestingly enough, San Quentin is a fairly good concert venue. I mean, not that there have been a lot of concerts there. You know, maybe I'm wrong, but didn't Johnny Cash play there, or was that Folsom Prison?
I know he did a recording at Folsom. People are always telling me he recorded at San Quentin, and he may have. You know, he may have given a concert there as well. But, I think I looked at the videos. So I think he did, actually, now that I think about it. The one that's really famous is Folsom, and I think he's got a song about it.
Yep, the Folsom Prison Blues, I think it's called. And yeah, no, I'm Googling this right now, and he definitely played at San Quentin. And I have a vague notion that B.B. King did. I'm just checking that right now.
Maybe, that may be.
He did. So there aren't a lot of concerts at San Quentin, but apparently on a percentage basis, they're all pretty amazing. How did you – now, when you were describing the musicians, it sounded like a lot of the musicians that you chose or approached – knew Frank and loved his music. So did you start with Liz? How did you figure out who to invite?
Well, George, I knew, had played with him a lot. And they did a duo album together, and he was very accessible. He's a really, really stand-up guy, and he was very open. And so I went to him first. And I also knew that Delfeo had played with him because Michael Connolly had seen him at, what's the name of this club in L.A. Catalina's. He'd seen them play together. So I went to Delfeo and asked him if he'd be in it. He said, yeah, sure. And then when I recontacted him like over a year later, he said, oh, you're really doing this? I just figured it would go away, as most things do. And I said, no, we're really doing it, and will you be the MC? And because he's got a real personality, you know.
Okay.
And he brought in Marvin Smitty Smith, and Ron Carter was a friend of Michael Connolly's. So, and we knew that he recorded with Frank, so we approached him. Mark Gross was a friend of Delfeo's. So that's how Mark came in. He's great. What a saxophone player. So he was like channeling Frank. And then I also knew about Grace Kelly as being Frank's protege, so I always wanted her in the film because she's a great character and part of the story I wanted to tell of redemption. So that's how it came about.
Now, had you ever produced a concert before?
No. I mean, I've been in a theater. I've done theater and film. And no, I've never produced a concert. I've never filmed in a prison. It was just like flying by the seat of your pants, but we were on a mission. That's all I can say. And it just came together.
And you had the skill, even though you had never done this particular thing before. You are a filmmaker. You have produced things, maybe not concert films in San Quentin, but you had produced things. So you've been down the general road before.
I had a producer, James Egan, who really helped make it happen. And, you know, we had a team, of course. Not a big team, but we had a team. So it did help a lot. We had really good sound recordists.
Had you ever shot a concert film before?
No, never.
Wow. How did you prepare for that? Because that's a different kind of thing. It's sort of like documentary filmmaking in a sense, because it's happening, it's unfolding right in front of you, and you don't control all the elements. But it's its own beast, you know, it's its own animal, a concert. So did you do some trial runs, maybe on simple concerts? Did you study other people's concert footage? How did you even go about planning it out?
I watched Martin Scorsese's Rolling Stones movie. He had like 12 cameras and they were zipping around on wires. So I knew I wasn't going to have that, but I did manage to get 6 cameras going. Three were on tripods and 3 of us were moving around. And so we discussed with the DP and we got decided who would be shooting what. And I got the name of a really good sound engineer, and so we knew that it was getting recorded right. I mean, he put a mic on each musician, and they were using whatever that thing is called. They were running the sound off an iPad, you know. And so I just kind of knew how I had to cover it, and I'd have to leave the music part of it to the musicians. You know, I knew they'd be good. It wasn't a question of... I knew the music
would
come together. Yeah.
That's the great thing about filming jazz, which I've done a little bit of. Yeah, you do not have to worry about the talent. They're right there. Did you as a crew, did you do a trial run? Did you do a smaller project that wasn't such high stakes, or did you just sort of all meet that day and set up and go?
No, we had a rehearsal at Yoshi's in Oakland, which is a real well-known jazz club. Yeah, so we rehearsed there on a stage. And, you know, everybody was there and just checking it out and getting a feel for it. And the musicians were rehearsing together. So it had, we got to know each other that way. We weren't completely cold going in to San Quentin.
Great.
And
that's
we
probably...
also had, yeah, we had a lot to set up in San Quentin. Like we had lights to set up, build a grid and set lights up. That was the most challenging thing, I would say.
Also, I imagine getting stuff into and out of the prison. Again, it's not like going to Yoshi's where the doors open and everything's casual. I imagine everything had to be checked out. And was there a lot of difficulties on that?
Oh, yeah. You had to have a manifest, and everything on the truck had to be, you know, clearly marked. And then everything that was brought in had to be checked off. And then every single thing that you brought in had to be brought out and checked off, down to the last screw. And they didn't want any ladders, and then the ladders had to be locked away during the concert because of obvious reasons, ladders in prison. And so there were a lot of security concerns, and that just added a level of stress that was intense. All the preparation was intense and stressful, but once the music started, we knew we had created something miraculous.
Great. Yeah, I can't wait to see this footage. I'm asking a lot of questions because sometimes people aren't aware of all that goes on to bring this footage into being. And I'm just thinking through, you know, what I'd have, you know, I'm thinking because I produced some concert films or shot concert stuff. And it's not easy even when it's easy. And if you're having to go into a high security prison in and out with your equipment, that's not so easy.
Well, it adds a level of excitement, let's put it that way.
It definitely it keeps you on your toes. Well, let's talk a little bit about Frank Morgan the man and Frank Morgan the musician. I'm sure you learned quite a bit about his life and his career and how it developed. Maybe for people that aren't as familiar with him, you could share some of the important highlights of his life.
He started out as, it was very evident from a very young age that he was very gifted. His father was a musician. He was in the Ink Spots, a guitarist. And he had, his parents were both not present. They were on the road all the time. And he grew up with his grandma in Milwaukee for a while. And then his dad had moved to L.A. and opened a nightclub, and he brought little Frankie out there when he was about 14. But the very initial, the aha moment was when he was about 7, his daddy took him to hear Charlie Parker, who was a buddy of his. I guess his dad used to go to Bird's hotel room and play changes, and Bird would improvise. And so he took him to a concert, and little Frankie had been studying guitar, and he heard this concert, and he turned to his father, and he said, "I don't know, I got to play that, whatever that is." Using saxophone, and it changed his life forever. And he had this relationship with Bird that, you know, like, really, sometimes he said his Bird was more of a father to him than his own dad. But he wanted to be so much like him that he, like quite a few musicians, decided he had to start taking dope, you know, to be as much like him as he could, to be in the club like him. And unfortunately, he really went deep into that addiction. He just couldn't, as many people, I mean, you know, he's not the only person who tried heroin and couldn't stop, for God's sakes. But it took over to the extent where he started committing petty crimes to get enough money to buy the drugs, and that's what led him to prison. So then his prison career overwhelmed his music career, and the only place he was playing was inside, but he kept playing.
Now, he spent a long time in prison cumulatively. Is that correct?
30 years in and out. He made his first album, 30,
wow.
He made his first album when he was 23, I think, which was a huge coup to be making his first album. And he made his second album when he was 53.
Wow. Now, was that one term, one 30-year term? No.
No, he was in and out. I mean, the film does deal with this. It's sort of revolving door incarceration where because he was a good guy, you know. He wasn't a horrible, disgusting, he never committed violent crimes or anything, but he would get arrested just for having drugs on him, for one thing, and as many people did, especially if they were black, and he just do something stupid, you know, and he'd wind up back in. He'd break his parole. And on it went. And they, you know, he'd go into rehab, but he couldn't manage, or he'd be okay for a short while, and then he'd fall again. And it was when he met this wonderful woman, Rosalinda Kolb, that something changed, because she really loved him, and she supported him. And something about her made him want to get out and stay out. And he also had the support of a very renowned jazz producer named Dick Bach in the West Coast, who says, get out and let's make an album. And that gave him a real impetus to change his ways. And it was from that moment when he had this album in the offing that he got out and stayed out.
A lot of musicians had their careers truncated by law enforcement issues. Charlie Parker's one of them. Thelonious Monk is another. You know, not that they were jailed, but in New York, in order to play, and New York is the Big Apple, and that's where you play. And if to play in New York, you need something called a cabaret card. And if you don't have one, you can't work. And so I know Monk had cabaret card problems. Charlie Parker did. Billie Holiday did.
Yeah.
Yep. And she was a specific target of I wish I could remember this guy's name, but a specific West Coast, you know, law enforcement person who just decided he was going to build or advance his own career by making her life miserable. But so, yeah, this is an unfortunate theme that definitely exists in the music, musicians banging up against this system. Now,
and the same
was
true in the West Coast. You know, there was Dexter Gordon was always getting sent away. Art Pepper. Art Pepper was in that big band at San Quentin.
Really? That must have been so Frank Morgan and Art Pepper in the same band? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Incredible,
that's
right?
Crazy. Wow. Now, my understanding is he finally got out of prison in 88. Is that right? Or 86?
85.
And then was he able to, those last years of his life, which amounted to 2 decades, he was able to stay out of prison, stay functional, produce, create? Is that pretty much accurate?
That's pretty much accurate. He never went back to jail. He actually, when he came out and recorded that album, he had broken parole. So he went back to his parole officer and said, I broke my parole. I want to finish this out and not have anything hanging on my head. So he went back to jail for 4 months. Mm-hmm. And then he was clear and free, and things started happening for him at the same time of getting bookings and the album coming out. And there was a lot of interest in him because of this story he had. And, you know, of course, because of his playing. And he was like this classic bebop player that other people had kind of moved on and changed what they were doing. And here he was still playing the most beautiful bebop. And so he just had a terrific third act. He recorded some 17 albums, I believe. He was on network TV a couple of times. He played the big clubs. He toured. He went to Europe. He really did well. He still struggled with drugs, but he had enough control, sort of methadone combination of things that he could manage and definitely stayed out of jail, which was the main thing. So, yeah, and, you know, he never stopped. I mean, the music just stayed beautiful. But also you could hear this unbelievable conflict in him between the need to make something beautiful and the way he had entrapped himself in so many ways. It just comes mm-hmm. out in that music. It is really heart-wrenching, very often very heart-wrenching.
And, of course, along the way, he made a lot of friends and supporters and colleagues. And I imagine their memories of him are featured in the film. Is that correct?
There are quite a few people who loved him. And there were also people who got really pissed off with him because he could be a little erratic in the recording sessions. And some of the guys, you know, they didn't like that too much. He'd get on them and he'd yell at them and he'd hurt their feelings. And one of the things about George Cables is that he was always able to let that just roll off his back. He just figured it was Frank's problem, not his. He was good about it. But he did have a kind of hot temper reputation. And Ron Carter says in the film, you know, he was erratic and he thought it was unconscionable the way he behaved, but then he'd start playing and he'd forget about all that. Huh.
Yeah, a little bit like Charlie Parker himself, who was a bit, from what I understand, could be on the erratic side, but once he started playing, what can you say?
Yeah, but the erratic stuff is the drugs. You know, it's like a third character. The true self is always the one that's playing the music. That's what I think. And people always could see, I mean, Frank, he could be like that, but at the same time, what everyone said was he had this very spiritual quality. He had something beautiful that came out of him. And you had to recognize that and choose that Frank and try to put the other Frank that was having a drug problem aside.
Gotcha. And he was devoted to bebop.
He was. He definitely was.
And,
I mean, he was a Charlie Parker protege, you know, that's one of his big things. It was interesting, you said earlier on you didn't want to label him. One of the things he said he had to learn was that he was not Charlie Parker, and he never was going to be Charlie Parker, that he was Frank Morgan. And, you know, it made me think a lot about somebody who's, you're 14 and you're labeled as the next genius, and you think to yourself, I can't be, like, I'm not that good, you know, and you start looking for some kind of crutches because you don't feel good enough in yourself. I really think that's one of the things that happened to Frank.
Well, to give people perspective on how amazing he was as a young player, Duke Ellington offered him Johnny Hodges' spot in his orchestra when Frank was 15 years old.
That's right.
I mean, that's just crazy.
Yeah. And then his father said, no, he's a kid. He's still in high school. You can't have him touring with you. And his father probably knew what that would be like, in a bus with that band.
But all our listeners know that, you know, to take, for anybody to take Johnny Hodges' spot into Gellington's band would be extraordinary, whether they were 15 or 55. But for it to be offered to a 15-year-old is just incomprehensible. He also had a chance to be part of the Clifford Brown and Max Roach Quintet, which would have been incredible. Mm. But that his problem with the criminal justice system interfered with that. That would have been amazing, because that role was filled by Harold Land, and then, of course, famously by Sonny Rollins. That was one of the great bands of all time. So what did you come away from? I already get a sense of how you feel about Frank, but you know, what did you come away from this experience of documenting his life and talking with people and listening to his recordings and so on?
Came away with, first of all, an appreciation of his beautiful art and how that really can surpass all other considerations. I came away with a lot of compassion for someone I think suffered incredibly. And, you know, I never thought of him as an evil guy. He wasn't a bad man. He was a man who had an addiction. And mm-hmm. really sad, really, really sad to think that, can't imagine what he would have done had he not spent 30 years in jail, how he would have changed and developed. But I also came away with an appreciation of just a beautiful soul who struggled through it all and yet came out with this music that he's left us with, that we can still appreciate and will go on appreciating.
And it's encouraging that the last 30 years of his life, or actually the last, I guess it was 20
like
years
20,
of his
yeah.
life, he did get to play. He stayed out and he got to play and he got to tour. He made it to New York. He recorded widely. He had his own protege, Grace Kelly. So he got to, you know, have a life after prison. Would you?
There's one other thing I should mention that I really knocked me out, which was the effect music can have on people like prisoners. What a release it is. What a tremendous gift it is for guys who can't get out of jail, or, you know, and people who've done horrible things, God knows. But to see that it can, you know, give them a moment of grace, let's say, really was very powerful for all of us who were at that concert that night.
Yeah, and I imagine that comes through in the film itself. In
other
words,
obviously
the music comes through, but the reaction of the people in the audience, the inmates.
It's incredible. It made the film 10 times more powerful than it would have been otherwise. It's something really, really something to see. I guarantee you
wow.
get goosebumps.
Well, speaking of which, this film is going to be screened both in New York City and L.A. So New York, it premieres on the 2nd of December. And could you tell us about the theater and the particulars about that, how long it will run as far as you know?
It's running at IFC Center, it's called, which those of you who go back a couple decades used to be the Waverly. It's a wonderful theater on 6th Avenue. The cross street is West 3rd, and if you're a New Yorker, you know the Blue Note's right there on West 3rd across the street, a couple blocks down from the Vanguard. And it's running there for a week starting December 2nd. It's really worth it to see it in a big theater with a big sound system. We mixed it Skywalker sound, and mixing the music was like an out-of-body experience, honest to God.
Mm-hmm.
It was wonderful. So that's the first run. And then we're playing at the Lemley Theater in Santa Monica starting December 18th for a week there. And again, I urge you, if you're in the area, to come see it for real, because it's so powerful on a big screen with the music. I mean, people rush up to me and say, when's the album coming out? It's a really wonderful, wonderful soundtrack.
Great, great. So, you know, our listeners on Jazz on the Tube, people listening to this interview, have seen dozens, hundreds, and if they're old-time fans of Jazz on the Tube, thousands of small screen videos, and those are amazing. But here's a rare chance to see the music showcased in a way that it rarely is showcased, with beautiful photography and everything set up, with lighting correct and professional sound recording and professional mix and NC talked about how good that mix is, shown on the big screen, and I imagine in New York and LA, you're going to have a lot of people in those seats. So I want to strongly encourage everybody who's listening, especially if you're in either of those big cities, or, you know, in LA, it could be, you know, anywhere from, you know, it's a huge area, LA, and then New York, of course, really covers a huge area too. Very worth checking this out. If you want more information about the film specifically, you can go to soundofredemption.com and you can put yourself on a mailing list. I'm sure the film is going to travel and be shown in other venues, but these are the big ones that are coming up, and I really, really want to encourage you all to strongly think about being in the audience when this thing is screened, because it's definitely going to be a one-of-a-kind experience. So, NC Hyken, thank you so much for your time, for making this film for us, and thank you for your time on the call. And
yeah, I want to say we also have a Facebook page, as everyone does. We have a Sound of Redemption Facebook page. You can check that out as well. And I urge you, as Ken has, come see it live. I want to see every single one of you in those theaters.
Well, you know, that's our mission at Jazz on the Tube. We have this website, and we have these thousands of videos, and you know, that's great. But what we're really all about is getting people to go out and see the music live. Now, this is not live, but it is a very special creation. And, you know, if it does well, maybe there'll be more like it, and I hope there are. So, again, NC, thank you so much, and we will see you probably, I hope, in New York City.
See you at the movies.
Okay, exactly. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you again. Bye.